For AntiWar.com and Chaos Radio in Austin, I'm Scott Horton. This is AntiWar Radio. Time to get to work here. I'm Scott. Thanks for tuning into the show, y'all. It's Anti-War Radio and Chaos in Austin. Like I was just saying about 45 seconds ago or something. Is it just me or is the whole damn internet going slow today or something? Thought they made all the internet tubes out of glass nowadays. Thought they could send 100 million petabytes down a tube at the speed of light without a problem. What the hell is the holdup? What? What's going on? All right. I'm just complaining. Hey, it's Friday. What am I complaining about? It's a good day to be, well, you or me, as far as I know. So thanks for tuning into the show. For people who have been listeners for a long time, I'm sorry that this whole first little bit here is going to be pretty repetitive to you. But then again, the lies of the war party get pretty repetitive. And I guess people can speculate as to exactly why the war party in this country is so intent on making the American people believe that the Iranians are making nuclear bombs. Now, here's the thing. Nobody in the whole world believes that they're making nuclear bombs. This is just for the American civilian population to be brainwashed into believing. Everybody else in the world, if you watch any foreign news and they talk about the Americans talking about the Iranian nuclear program, their eyebrows get all furled and they say to each other, you know, the anchor and the reporter, when they do their little couple follow-up questions after the report, they say, what the hell are these Americans talking about? They're crazy, aren't they? Yes, in fact, that seems to be the conclusion. This is just for you, these lies. They're not for the rest of the people of the world who all know better. And, you know, what, like it's going to justify a war against Iran, an invasion? What, America's going to steal that country again like back in the 50s? It was a lot more ripe for the taking back then, I think you understand. And they didn't march troops in. They just did a coup d'etat and created a brutal, torturous military dictatorship. The Slavic, of course, unless, you know, the American establishment has their way, we'll go down in world history as one of the most brutal secret police forces in the history of the world. That's how they did it before. I'm not so sure how anyone in the American establishment really believes that they're going to be able to take Iran from the Iranian people again, with or without nuclear weapons. You know, you think the war in Iraq has been difficult. Well, hell, just that. Think how difficult the war in Iraq will be if there's a war with Iran. Never mind the difficulty of the Iran war. Just how much more difficult will the Iraq war get at that point? Much more. But trying to invade Persia? Come on. America's not going to invade Persia. We can't. Best we can do is bomb them, and then what good does that do? The only good that does, as far as, you know, accomplishing the goals of the war party, is if you believe their most foolish of theoreticians, people like William Crystal, who's never been right about anything. I forgot, was it, I think, on Digby's blog, she said this guy's never met a disaster that he wasn't responsible for. Is Digby a she? I don't, what the hell do I know about liberal bloggers? Something Glenn linked to. But anyway, if you get your foreign policy cues from Bill Kristol, then you might believe that the Iranian people want to be bombed, and they want to take that opportunity to rise up against the Ayatollah's regime. All they're waiting for is for a benevolent American military force to come and help them by dropping bombs all over their cities. You know, just on government buildings and that kind of thing. We have real high-tech satellite-guided weapons nowadays. We never miss. So if you believe that, then there's, you know, any kind of point, maybe, from the imperialist point of view, of why you might bomb that country. Otherwise, all there is to bomb is a civilian nuclear program. A civilian nuclear program that is safeguarded, that is, quote, capital S, safeguarded, unquote, as Gordon Prather would write it. It's a legal term. It means that they are in compliance with their IAEA agreements. Simple as that. Iran has been a member of the Non-Proliferation Treaty since the 70s. They have never been in violation of it, though they did keep portions of their nuclear program secret. That wasn't a violation of the Non-Proliferation Treaty, which only said that they declare their facilities 6 months before introducing nuclear fuel into the cycle, etc. like that. So they never were in violation of the treaty, and they never have been in violation of their safeguards agreement with the International Atomic Energy Agency, which is basically the teeth. When you're a non-nuclear weapon state and you join the Non-Proliferation Treaty, you promise to let the IAEA inspectors into your country to make sure that you're not diverting nuclear material to a military or other special purpose, quote-unquote, as in their mandate. And, well, so that's what's been happening, is the IAEA all along has been monitoring all of this stuff. And whenever they have been forced to admit by communist terrorist cult, the Mujahideen al-Khalq, their political front group, the Sinn Féin to their IRA, if you will, the National Council for Resistance in Iran came out with information that they did have a secret nuclear facility being built at Natanz, not that anything nuclear was happening there. At that time, they even published pictures in the BBC back in 2005. It was a giant, empty, you know, underground Walmart-sized building, basically. And but there was nothing going on in there. And of course we know that because of Scott Ritter's reporting and Gareth Porter's and others, that the Mujahideen al-Khalq and their National Council for Resistance in Iran are really just fronts. Well, not just fronts, but they certainly are fronts for Israeli intelligence. And that's where the information about Natanz came from anyway. But so once they said, okay, yeah, we have a facility at Natanz, but we're not in violation of any of our agreements because there's nothing nuclear going on there, and there won't be for more than a year now, so we're certainly not within 6 months in the time frame and what have you. Since then, and since they began to introduce nuclear material there, IAEA inspectors are there on site. They have basically carte blanche. In fact, for 2 or 3 years there, I guess 2 years, the Iranians were abiding by what's called an additional protocol to their safeguards agreement. That is, again, their agreement that is the teeth in their signature to the Non-Proliferation Treaty that our government has also signed and is obliged to respect, and which here, you know, in small parentheses, guarantees their unalienable right to pursue nuclear technology for peaceful purposes. But that additional protocol said you have carte blanche. You can do anything, go anywhere. You can ask us for any report that has anything to do with anything nuclear whatsoever. And they gave up all kinds of paperwork on bench level studies and small things at the university, this, that, and the other thing. Now I know that you've seen headlines all over the places say, Scott Wharton. The fact is that the IAEA is quite frustrated by the Iranians' refusal to comply with all the demands of the UN Security Council and the International Atomic Energy Agency. And Mohammed El-Baradei keeps saying things like, boy, we wish we could get better answers out of them, but they won't give them to us, and we're not done getting all the answers we're looking for yet, et cetera, like that. Well, here's the thing about that. Context. Context, context. that so-called investigation that the Iranians will not 1,000,000% comply with, although you would think that 100% would be good enough, or really, you know, 98% or something, are completely illegal. I mean, never mind that the U.S. Senate and House of Representatives had no authority to sign America up to join the United Nations in the first place, and, you know, the whole thing's ridiculous, but, you know, if you believe in all of that stuff, the international law does not allow for this other investigation by the IAEA. It is not part of their safeguards agreement. It is not part of their signature to the Non-Proliferation Treaty. These are simply unilateral demands made by the UN Security Council with heavy arm twisting by the United States, as Gordon Prather would call them, Bush, Rice, Bolton, Bush, Cheney, Rice, Bolton, you know, with dashes in between all their names. And they basically mandate that the IAEA investigate and figure out every single question that they can come up with based on a laptop that supposedly came from a dead Iranian scientist, and that this pilfered laptop had all these secret documents in it that proved their nuclear weapons program. And so the IAEA has had a separate investigation that's completely apart from their obligations, the Iranians' obligations under the Non-Proliferation Treaty and their safeguards agreement. And this entire other investigation is based on this stolen laptop and the accusations that come from it. And they have answered a lot of the questions. I guess I should say another part of this was they found some traces of highly enriched uranium on a couple of pieces of centrifuge equipment. But basically, the particles match up perfectly with Pakistani nuclear material, and that's where they got the equipment from. And I guess the Pakistanis didn't outright confirm that, oh yeah, that's our highly enriched uranium, don't worry about that. But it was basically pretty obvious where the statement that they used was diplomatic speak for, you know, sure could have been, that kind of thing. Pretty obvious that there was no, the Iranians had no ability to enrich highly enriched uranium for them to have a little bit of residue on equipment that hadn't even, I don't even think at that point, been assembled and put into use yet. They had just got it from the Pakistanis. So that was one question that had to be answered. The rest of it all came from the laptop, and it was answered. The rest of it all came from the laptop, and the laptop is just bogus. It's fake. And Gareth Porter's done some great reporting on this and shown how you could give an intelligence agency credit for making some good guesses as to what an Iranian nuclear program scientist's documents might look like or something, but basically they were only educated guesses, and they were wrong in quite a few places that were very revealing. And in fact, anyone who wants to really get into the story of the so-called smoking laptop, you know, like the smoking gun, supposedly full of evidence or whatever, I would just suggest Googling laptop, and the name's Gareth Porter, and that would be one search, and then laptop, and the other name, Gordon Prather, both of whom write for antiwar.com, and both of whom have done quite a bit of work. And, you know, obviously you can read Walter Pincus and Daphne Linzer in the Post and all the official stuff, whatever, it's all out there. Scott Ritter, of course, I should not neglect to mention, wrote a great article for Truthdig all about this stolen laptop not long after the last time I interviewed him, when I asked him all about this laptop. And I think he turned around and decided he was going to write an article all about it, where he went through and basically showed that this is totally bogus. And in fact, I'll go through some of it for you. Supposedly they were making a delivery vehicle for a warhead, but the delivery vehicle that they were making would not fit any nuclear warhead that the Iranians are accused of trying to make. They're not, no one's saying that they're harvesting plutonium and making a miniaturized plutonium warhead boosted with tritium and all these things that you need to miniaturize a nuclear warhead, according to the Cox Committee report. We're talking about gun-type nuke. gun type, uranium nukes is what they're being accused of trying to make progress toward one day somehow being able to make or something. And that's not going to fit on this. That was, in fact, part of the reason they came up with that whole lie about the North Koreans working with the Syrians to make a plutonium plant to give nuclear weapons material to Iran so that then they could fit the warhead on the missile. Yeah, you bought that one, right? Anyway, and then they said, oh, look, they had this green salt project. That's on the laptop. Again, manufactured by the Israelis and perhaps somewhat describing something that, you know, existed actually on paper in Iran, a plan to build some facility and use lasers to purify yellow cake uranium ore to uranium tetrafluoride level, which is five fluorides stuck together, I guess is how that works. And yet that doesn't make any sense, because in order to enrich uranium in your centrifuge, it needs to be uranium hexafluoride gas, six fluorides, I guess, you know, whatever, working together. Uranium hexafluoride gas, that's what you need to put it in there. So laser enrichment, and in fact, a bench scale, you know, paperwork describing a proposed bench scale laboratory to make tetrafluoride, uranium tetrafluoride, makes no sense whatsoever when we know for a fact that they have facilities openly, again, declared and safeguarded by the IAEA that make uranium hexafluoride. So the whole accusation about the so-called green salt, that's what another name for uranium tetrafluoride, so-called green salt, the whole, you know, spin behind that obviously makes no sense. And anyway, on and on like that. So if you remember back in November of 2007, when all American intelligence agencies, led by Thomas Fingar, who is the director of the National Intelligence Council at the time. The National Intelligence Council is basically made up of the leaders of all the different intelligence agencies. They say there's 16 or 17 of them or whatever. Anyway, they came up with this national intelligence estimate that said all their indications are that the Iranians gave up their nuclear program. And this was the declassified version, right? I don't think anybody's ever leaked the classified version. But the declassified version said, you know, we're under the impression that they had a nuclear weapons program, or at least were looking at putting something together and what it would take to do it or whatever, but that they called this off in 2003, that they made this strategic decision that they just weren't even going to pursue nuclear weapons. It would be more trouble than it was worth. They'd probably get them attacked before they were able to use it, I guess, or whatever. And that, so all their production of nuclear weapons material or whatever ceased in 2003. Well, we know now that, well, at least all indications are that I know of, I guess is the best way to say that. All indications are that the only thing that says that they had a nuclear weapons program before 2003 is the bogus laptop that was made up by the Israelis and funneled through the communist terrorist cult, the Mujahideen al-Khalq, which used to work for the Ayatollah Khomeini and then worked for Saddam Hussein and now works for the American DOD, has a little base north of Baghdad protected by American Marines. This is where the laptop came from, and that's where the accusations that they ever had a nuclear weapons program in Iran come from. And meanwhile, every 6 months or so, Mohammed El-Baradei and the International Atomic Energy Agency put out a report that says that they have no indication, not only do they have no evidence, they have no indication that the Iranians have diverted any of their nuclear material to a military or other special purpose, as is their mandate. And they have done nothing but verify that and verify that and verify that. So, what a bunch of crap. And how could it be that the American people really... Any major percentage above even, okay, maybe I'll give you the 24% or whatever that still think George Bush was a great leader or whatever. Boy, I mean, what's that about except not being able to admit how wrong you've been up until the point that you have to admit it, huh? Jeez. But beyond that, the idea that any government, whether it's, you know, the savior Barack Obama or anybody else – could tell us that, hey, there's this country that starts with the IRA and they're making nuclear weapons and something's got to be done about it, and that we would sit there and nod and smile and accept that without solid proof, without the smoking gun being an actual mushroom cloud. Screw that. They are liars. Liars. And again, if you watch the BBC or Al Jazeera or, you know, the translated news from Japan or anything else, and the subject is Iran and the nuclear program, the news anchor guys look at each other and go, how can the Americans say that there's a nuclear weapons program? Well, I don't know, Jim. Well, but didn't their own intelligence agencies just come out with a report in November of 2007 that said that there's not a nuclear weapons program there? Yeah, that's right. And isn't the IAEA there safeguarding everything? Yeah, that's right. And the IAEA says that they're only enriching uranium to industrial grade, less than 4% pure uranium-235, completely and totally unsuitable for use in a nuclear weapon. Isn't that right? Right? And everyone in the whole world knows it. All 6.5 billion people, less the 300 million that live between Canada and Mexico. Is that basically it? Yeah, I'm afraid so. So are we going to have a war? Could be. And geez, I'm puzzled too. I don't know. What does that make me? A foreigner? Shit. I don't think so. I'm not quite from around here, boy, but I am from Texas. That's part of the Union ever since, you know, the great surrender of 1685. So, yeah, man, what did I say, 1685? I meant 1865. Wow, that was cool. I got my 6 and my 8 backwards. That was an interesting one. What exactly is behind that? Neurons getting crossed, or, like, the picture of my mind getting dyslexic, or what the hell is going on? Anyway, so whenever your government tells you, even if it's His Holiness Barack Obama, peace be upon him, and all that cool shit, when he says that the Iranians are making nuclear weapons, he is a liar. And in fact, that may be an indication that he is a premeditated murderer. When he's acting just like George Bush and Dick Cheney and Paul Wolfowitz and, you know, Douglas Feith acted in 2002 and 2003. Oh yeah, those Iranians, they're making nuclear bombs. They're gonna, I guess, use them on us, right? They're gonna nuke Los Angeles and nuke Austin, Texas, if we don't nuke them first. And by the way, how else are you gonna blow up the Natanz facility, which is buried under 90 feet of granite, other than using nuclear weapons? And by the way, if you heard Bunker Buster Nuke and you thought, oh, it must dig deep underground, and then when it goes off, it looks like that footage I've seen of the Pakistani underground nuclear test where the ground kind of bubbles up and then craters down. No, it's not like that. Remember the footage you've seen of Hiroshima and the giant atom bomb cloud in the sky and the 100,000 dead people in an instant? Yeah, it's more like that. It may dig down into the ground a little bit before it goes off, but still. And, you know, because that can work on you, right? It's all visual. Oh, Bunker Buster Nuke. Sounds like it might not shoot a giant cloud of killer radioactive dust into the air. Wrong. That's exactly what it does. And how else are you going to blow up Natanz other than using Bunker Buster Nukes? And who cares if the Iranians are enriching uranium to a measly less than 4% at Natanz from here to eternity? And, in fact, who cares if they make hydrogen bombs? What are they going to do? Shoot them in North America? Give me a break. I'll tell you something, folks. There's one country in the world, well, actually two, that have thousands of hydrogen bombs. Well, at least thousands of nuclear bombs, and at the very least hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of hydrogen bombs. And, yeah, I am speaking to you now from one of those countries. America could turn every grain of sand in Persia to glass. And that's another thing that everyone in the whole world knows. Who's got the nuclear weapons program? We do. who's used nuclear weapons before in battle? The United States of America, under the command of the Klansman Harry Truman. Let me see. Other lies about Iran. Well, I guess that's one of them too, right? Is that, oh yeah, don't you know, Scott Horton, they would nuke North America because they're crazy. Oh, the Ayatollahs, they're crazy. They believe in a weird religion, and that weird religion says that they want their whole country to be turned to glass. And apparently that's why we have to oblige them. Yeah. Okay. Show me an Iranian actually saying that. Show me any source for that information other than Michael Ledeen and the guys over at the National Review. Show me a credible source for the people who run Iran are trying to get their entire civilization destroyed permanently. That is so stupid. It shouldn't even need to be refuted. It just stands, you know, right there on its own. Now, Americans, I could see Americans being lemmings enough to basically, you know, follow a Barack Obama type leader in a Jim Jones Kool-Aid self-immolation massacre kind of thing. I could see Americans being such followers to go for, you know, such a thing. We see the path of destruction we're on right now while everybody cheers at the top of their lungs. But could Iranians possibly be so immature? Come on. Couldn't be. It just couldn't be true, really. Because I don't want to admit that I live in a world where everybody's as childish as a bunch of stupid-ass Americans who apparently are literally willing to let Barack Obama pick up his lies about what other people's countries are doing and why they very well may need to be bombed over it. Pick up right where the former emperor left off. With the exact same lies. And now, I'm sorry, because here, I'm just going off, but here. Los Angeles Times, from yesterday. Reporting from Washington, this is Greg Miller. In a reversal since a 2007 report, U.S. officials expect the Islamic Republic to reach development milestones this year. Reporting from Washington little more than a year after U.S. spy agencies concluded that Iran had halted work on a nuclear weapon, the Obama administration has made it clear that it believes there is no question Tehran is seeking the bomb. In his news conference this week, President Obama went so far as to describe Iran's, quote, development of a nuclear weapon, before correcting himself to refer to its pursuit of weapons capability. Oh, I see. Obama's nominee to serve as CIA director, Leon E. Panetta, who said that he would seek presidential authority to torture people if it was a ticking time bomb scenario like that TV show, but that was another case here, left little doubt about his view last week when he testified on Capitol Hill, quote, from all the information I've seen, Panetta said, I think there is no question that they are seeking that capability. The language reflects the extent to which senior U.S. officials now discount a national intelligence estimate issued in November 2007 that was instrumental in derailing U.S. and European efforts to pressure Iran to shut down its nuclear program. And in fact, if you go to antiwar.com right now and you look at Jason Ditz's new summary of this story here, you will see where he links to Thomas Fingar, who was the head of the National Intelligence Council, who how he just a couple of months ago, on his way out the door, reaffirmed that he knows of no reason to revise that National Intelligence Estimate's conclusion that there is no nuclear weapons program in Iran. If you heard the show the other day, you heard me talk with Philip Giraldi, former CIA counterterrorism officer. I asked him if he had heard anything, and he breaks stories. He's, you know, plugged into the underground of what's going on up there in the imperial capital and that kind of thing. Has he heard anything from any of his CIA buddies at all about new information about, oh, there really is something going on in Iran? And he said no. The only thing they got is that if we were them, we would be making nukes, no doubt about it, so they must be. That's all they got? Not that he was, you know, trying to say what we needed to do about it or whatever like that in that sense. But he was just saying, yeah, safe assumption. They got to have a hollowed-out mountain making nukes somewhere, right? Because otherwise, They're crazy. They'd be crazy not to be making nuclear weapons right now. But anyway, Thomas Fingar, hey, I know you're saying, yeah, but Scott, November 2007, that's like ancient history. So much has happened since then. Well, Philip Giraldi hadn't heard a peep of any new information that says that, yes, in fact, they are making nuclear weapons over there. And Thomas Fingar, the official, outgoing head of the National Intelligence Council, said the same thing, just a couple of months ago. Okay, sorry. So that was a little, large parenthesis there. Back to the LA Times. As the administration moves towards talks with Iran, do they move toward talks with Iran? Appears to be sending a signal that the United States will not be drawn into a debate over Iran's intent. Oh, certainly not. When you're talking about negotiations in Iran, it's dangerous to appear weak or naive, said Joe Cirincione, a nuclear weapons expert and president of the Plowshares Fund, an anti-proliferation organization based in Washington. Cirincione said the unequivocal language also worked to Obama's political advantage. It guards him against criticism from the right that the administration is underestimating Iran, he said. Well, geez, I mean, I could have said that same thing. I would hope that that Joe Cirincione isn't trying to justify that. Obama deliberately looking the American people right in the eye and lying to them about a Middle Eastern country's nuclear weapons program, exactly like what happened with his predecessor talking about the country next door. It's hardly defendable. You got to protect yourself from the right. How about use truth against them? How about beat them over the head with the fact that they are liars? That there is no nuclear weapons program to worry about at all. In fact, that's even better. In fact, he could, you know, Barack Obama, he'd get his timing down and practice in front of the mirror 70 times exactly how to say it. The Republicans are cowards. They fear the boogeyman. But let us not be cowards like Republicans and fear nuclear weapons programs that do not exist. And blah, blah, blah. God, they were playing Obama on the radio. I'm about ready to puncture my own eardrums. I just don't know if I can put up with this. I mean, George Bush was kind of funny, but 8 years, maybe just four, but even then, years to go of this guy and his practiced cadence rhetoric crap. Oh, God, I just can't take it. But, anyway. Barack Obama. I can't believe you people fell for that thing. They told me, oh, Barack Obama, he's a rock star. That day, or the next day, I showed up on Chaos Radio to do the Chaos Report with Bianca Oblivion. I said, Bianca Oblivion, who the hell is this Barack Obama guy? He's a senator? She says, oh yeah. I said, well, TV says he's a rock star and that I love him. I didn't hear him talk yet, but I saw his picture and he just looks like some used car salesman, two-bit city council politician to me. What's so impressive about him? And I believe her response was, I don't know, or something along those lines. But yeah, you know, Obama needs to protect himself from the right by repeating every lie that they say and accepting every one of their false premises. Great strategy. Yeah, that way you won't be pressured into following their policy prescriptions, right? Like Chris Floyd says, hey, yeah, he's a cool, progressive murderer, torturer, wiretapper, terrorist, murderer. But he's hip and cool and progressive, so get on the bandwagon, dude. I saw a bumper sticker yesterday on a car that said, Rage Against the Machine. And I thought, yeah, I like those guys, man. They hate the government a lot. And yeah, they're commies, but they hate the government a lot, too. That's sort of contradictory, but whatever. They hate this government. Anyway, that's cool. And then on the other side was an Obama sticker. A Rage Against the Machine sticker, which forget the band for a minute, but just the name of the band. Rage. Against the Machine is the name of the band. That's the name of the, that's what the sticker read. And then on the other side of the bumper, Obama? Which machine are you raging against? It's like the American people took such a deep sleep that they woke up with their eyes so crusted over they just can never see again or something. I don't know. It seems like the cult of George Bush didn't wear off all that long ago. It seems like people would be able to compare in their own mind, huh, you know, this whole I love the president thing is eerily reminiscent of everybody loving the last guy who everybody finally decided actually was horrible. In fact, perhaps some of them even recognized that the degree to which they loved him was the degree to which he could get away with being absolutely horrible. And a little bit of a correlation and a causation kind of thing there. You might look into it. 90% approval rating, Mr. President. Let's start another war. That's basically how it goes. So back to this ridiculous Los Angeles Times article. Iran has long maintained that it aims to generate electricity, not build bombs with nuclear power. But Western intelligence officials and nuclear experts increasingly view those claims as implausible. U.S. officials said that although no new evidence has surfaced to undercut the findings of the 2007 estimate, there was growing consensus that it provided a misleading picture and that the country was poised to reach crucial bomb-making milestones this year. Just don't tell me what those are, though, okay? Why don't you just go ahead and be vague? Because, you know, now we're talking nuclear stuff, and that's really complicated and scientific, and I don't think that I can stand having, you know, sixth grade level earth science material in my Los Angeles Times article. So thanks for just leaving that out and not confusing the issue with facts. Like, what milestone are you talking about? What does that mean? That they expect that later this year, for example, they're going to withdraw from the non-proliferation treaty and kick out the IAEA? No, no one expects that. Well, then how are they supposed to accomplish any milestone at all on the road to developing a nuclear weapon if they don't kick out the IAEA? Right. They're not going to make any milestones toward a nuclear weapon at all this year because they've got IAEA inspectors with white lab coats and doohickeys in their hand that go beep and monitor their nuclear progress. Oh, but Anonymous, apparently, or I don't know exactly who all they talk to. Intelligence officials fear. Oh, well, okay. Let's go with that. They're gonna pass milestones. Crucial bomb-making milestones will be passed this year. Obama's top intelligence official, Dennis C. Blair, the director of national intelligence, Butcher of Timor, is expected to address mounting concerns over Iran's nuclear program in testimony before the Senate Intelligence Committee today. When it was issued, the NIE stunned the international community. It declared that U.S. spy agencies judge, quote, with high confidence that in the fall of 2003, Tehran halted its nuclear weapons program. Now, that's just not true. They might have been stunned by the fact that the NIE was allowed to ever be released saying that, but the entire international community already knew that, and so did you, if you were listening to this show, because back in October 2006, Philip Giraldi wrote in the American Conservative magazine, and Gareth Porter wrote in IPS News that there is a national intelligence estimate on Iran and Dick Cheney is doing everything he can to suppress it. And that went on for more than a year. A couple of months later, Seymour Hersh came out with an article called The Next Act, which said in it, there's a NIE, Dick Cheney suppressing it. The Israelis and the CIA, with their heads together, cannot come up with a single atom of evidence anywhere on the face of the earth that there's a nuclear weapons program in that country, reported Seymour Hersh in The New Yorker in November of 2006. Oh, the international community was shocked, except for everyone who lives anywhere but between Maine and San Diego. Between Maine and San Diego, people were shocked. Except those who read antiwar.com. everyone else on Earth said, yeah, we know. The IAEA safeguards all their nuclear facilities. Of course they don't have a nuclear weapons program. So no, Los Angeles Times, the international community, if they were shocked at all, you interpret their shock incorrectly. It was not that it was just that they were allowed to say that there was no program at all. That was the shocking part. That somehow Thomas Fingar had beat Dick Cheney in a bureaucratic turf war. That was the shocking part. Now, here's my favorite. U.S. officials said that although no new evidence had surfaced to undercut the findings of the 2007 National Intelligence Estimate, there was a growing consensus that it provided a misleading picture and that the country was poised to reach crucial bomb-making milestones. Oh, see, I already did say that, didn't I? I just emphasized the second half of it before I emphasized the first half of it. No new evidence, they admit. Right there. There's no evidence that they're making a nuclear bomb, but we're convinced that they are going to pass major bomb-making milestones this year, but we can't say what they are. They have centrifuges. And look at the, God, this is crappy reporting. By November, Iran had produced an estimated 1,400 pounds of low-enriched uranium, not nearly enough to fuel a nuclear energy reactor, but perilously close to the quantity needed to make a bomb. Well, how much low-enriched uranium do you need to make a bomb? Get it? It's like a riddle. Because you can't make a bomb out of low-enriched uranium. Hardy har har. Pretty funny, huh? Alright, so, I'm tired of this. Let me think, more lies. They claim Iran ever undercut America's mission in Iraq. Wrong. America's project, since George Bush had that country basically put up against the wall and shot back in 2003, has been to install the Iranian puppets in power. The Supreme Council for Islamic Revolution in Iraq are Iranian puppets. The Dawa Party are Iranian puppets. More and more, the Mahdi Army seems to be in league with the Iranians as well. This is the Shiite coalition, the United Iraqi Alliance. In fact, at least one of the other factions, I forget, if not both, of the Kurds are in bed with the Iranians as well. These are the people the Americans have put in power in Iraq. I'm sure the Ayatollah thanks Allah for getting the Americans to blunder so stupidly in their advantage every night. Maybe five times a day. Oh, yeah, you know, the reason things aren't perfect in Iraq, you know, 2 years ago, last year, right now, and a year from now is because of what the Iranians are up to. Oh, yeah, what's that? Providing the puppets that America's chosen to install in power in Iraq? I guess I could see why that's a crime. Certainly not against America. But, you know, of course, the selfless American empire, they're not looking out for us. They're looking out for the Iraqis. You don't know how the hell the Iranians successfully bamboozled them into doing everything their way. They have no idea. Let's see. What are some more lies about Iran? Oh, if we bomb them, then it'll start a nuclear war where Russia will then... Russia and China, maybe? Will then invade Israel and cause Jesus to come back and murder all the Jews and take all the Pentecostals up to heaven in their human forms. That also is not true. Nah. Sorry. I usually don't like to get into refuting people's ridiculous religions, because whatever. I don't care. You believe whatever you want. But that... No, that's a bunch of crap. And if you believe that, you're a fucking idiot. Seriously, you are an idiot. if you think that the Bible says that a country that wasn't going to exist for 2,000 years yet over in North America has a biblical role in fomenting a nuclear war that kills everybody in Israel and apparently Russia and China and whatever mythology you believe into, so that you can go up to heaven in your human body when God throws you the golden rope. It doesn't even make sense according to your own religion. Ever heard of the tribulation? You think that's for everybody but you? Oh no, that's how you know that you're the true believer in Christianity, is you suffer the most. Ain't no golden rope for you. You start a nuclear war, you die in it. Sorry, again, anybody can believe in any kind of version of whatever religion they want, and I really don't care. But if you think that getting into a war with Iran is part of making the Bible become real and predicting the future and whatever, then you're just stupid. And really, everyone ought to, like, kind of cover their mouth, and but then still point and laugh at you. Of all the ridiculous things that politicians have had their allies in organized religion fool their sheep, their flock, into believing, that's probably the most foolish thing of all, ever. Start a war to force Jesus to come back now because we said so, to kill all the Jews and take you up to heaven. Stupidest religion ever. And understandably, that's coming from a guy who actually thinks that stupidest is a word, or will use it anyway, knowing it's not. But still, I'm pretty sure that that's about as dumb as a religion can be. And stupid is as stupid knows as stupid does. So let's see, what other Iran lies? I actually got this on a piece of paper over here, don't I? Let me see. Yeah, Joshua Frank was over. He pointed at my little cheat sheet. Lies about Iran. It's all a mess. You can hardly read it. Oh, they're in bed with Al-Qaeda? No, they're not. I just interviewed Philip Giraldi, the terrorism expert, CIA guy, former CIA guy on the show, 2 days ago. And he said, nope, not true. No evidence. Whatever. BS. A little bit of tactical help here, there, or somewhere, possibly, but not proven. But a real operational relationship? No. Weekly Standard and the Saudi prince's newspapers can say whatever they want. Doesn't make it true. I briefly mentioned the lies that North Korea and Syria had a joint project to make nuclear weapons fuel out of plutonium in Syria in order to give it to Iran so they could fit it in the delivery vehicle that the Israelis pretend they were making to do. Yeah, that's not true either. And it's still not a shred of evidence that that was even a nuclear facility being built there in Syria. And in fact, the evidence that there is, I don't even think it's a likely inference that that was actually a nuclear facility being built there in Syria. You know, the one that the Israelis bombed on September 6th, 2007. Yeah, what a load of crap that was. Now, let's see. I already ridiculed the make Jesus come back thing. Oh, Argentina. Oh, they always say, and you'll see this in newspapers everywhere. Oh, yeah. You know, the Iranians were responsible for Hezbollah bombing a Jewish community center in Argentina back in 1994 or 92 or whatever it was. That is such a load of crap. Why are people so desperate to believe things that aren't true? I mean, there are plenty of true things to find out and then believe in that, right? People are desperate to believe lies. I don't even think you have to have a dog in that fight, right? You don't even have to care one way or another about Argentina or Jewish community centers or Hezbollah. But if somebody tells you a story like that, it's like the degree to which it ain't true is the degree to which you want to think you know something now. Wow, yeah, Hezbollah and that Jewish community center. No, it's just bogus crap. And again, I can point to Dr. Gareth Porter and his excellent work. I think this one was in the American Prospect. And there's other reporting on this, but Gareth obviously is the best. And it was a bunch of right-wing, fascist, Nazi sympathizer type guys in the secret police forces there that did it. Not Hezbollah. What a bunch of crap. You know, when Osama bin Laden and his friends bombed the Khobar Towers in Saudi Arabia in 1993, I think it was 93, killing 19 American servicemen and some Saudi civilians as well, I think. They blamed it on Hezbollah. And I know you're saying Hezbollah in Saudi Arabia. I thought Hezbollah was in Lebanon. Well, you know, all the oil part of Saudi Arabia is Shiite land there. And so I don't know whether there ever was such a thing as a Saudi Hezbollah, but I guess it was possible. But the American politicians decided that rather than trying to figure out who bombed the American bases of the American occupiers of the land of the two holy places there, nudge, nudge, rather than try to figure out who done it, they wanted to blame it on Hezbollah. I guess because AIPAC said so. I guess because a foreign lobby's influence in this country is so vast that a police investigation, a military intelligence investigation into who slaughters a bunch of sleeping servicemen in their barracks gets turned over to political hacks. And if they decide they want to blame Hezbollah and Iran, then that's exactly what they'll do. And yet now we know that it was Osama bin Laden that did that, of course. You can read that great article by that one guy in the Village Voice, what was his name? And wrote the great article about Rudy Giuliani's friend Al Thani, who bin Laden stayed at his farm while they were bringing the explosives into the country, and that it happened right over the fence in the adjacent province of the United Arab Emirates. Like, it was one fence away from that part of Saudi Arabia where the barracks was. And they just decided that they would put off trying to find out who did this when it was bin Laden who did it. That was in 93. That was just, I think it was in 93, just a few months after the first World Trade Center bombing. Long before the embassies in Tanzania and Dar es Salaam. Long before the USS Cole. Long before September 11th. But they decided that, you know what? Screw those 19 dead kids. Who cares who really killed them? And holding those people responsible, let's blame it on Iran. Let's pretend it was them. And then there's the whole thing, wipe off the map. We all know now that that's not what he said. Ahmadinejad, who is, as Juan Cole compared him, is like the American Secretary of the Interior. And he even specified, now for foreigners listening, they think Secretary of the Interior, that sounds like the head of the secret police, you know? But in America, the Secretary of the Interior is nobody. He's in charge of ripping off Indians and, you know, whatever, parks and recreation and, yeah. And Juan Cole says, yeah, that's what Ahmadinejad's job is. He's not in charge of the Revolutionary Guard Corps. He's not in charge of the military. He's not in charge of foreign policy. He certainly isn't in charge of nuclear policy. And he's not in charge of threatening to wipe other countries off the map. That would have been way out of his league anyway. And he never said it. What he said was, fascism disappeared from history. And so did communism. They thought it would never fall, the giant Soviet Union. And yet, it's gone. And soon Zionism will join them and vanish from the page of time. Zionism would vanish from the page of time, he said. That's not quite the same thing as we're going to kill all the Jews on the eastern shore of the Mediterranean Sea, there is it? It's not quite the same thing at all. Most people know better than that. Now, in fact, even the bombing of the Beirut embassy, or the Beirut barracks. I don't know about the American embassy. I know the barracks in Beirut in 1983, as though this is a reason to you know, get into a conflict with these people now, anyway. But that wasn't even Hezbollah that did it. It was the Amal militia that did it. A breakoff from Hezbollah, who thought that Hezbollah was too close to Iran. Ah! Sorry. Not even your fabled Beirut barracks bombing can be put at the feet of Iran. Let's see, is that really, and I covered the Bill Kristol fantasy that the people in Iran want us to bomb them. If anybody else can think of any more lies about Iran that need debunking, let me know. It's about the best I can do for now. And god dang, it just hit me as I sat down to do this show. I think I'm coming down with a fever, man. I'm sweating. I think I need coffee. Or maybe Dr. Pepper. I like Dr. Pepper. That's not a commercial for Dr. Pepper. It's just a statement of fact. Here, how about you guys listen to some Knockdown Stiss? We'll be back. It's Anti-War Radio on Chaos in Austin. Alright, y'all, welcome back to Anti-War Radio. It's Chaos in Austin, I'm Scott Horton. It's funny, usually the time just flies by. It's going slow today. That seemed like 2 or 3 hours worth of complaining about Barack Obama and his government's lies. about Iran, which can only serve to, well, I guess it can serve a couple of different purposes, but certainly can help to serve as an excuse to go to war. That's funny. You know, there used to be this guy named Mace Price that hung out at the Stress blog. And it's been almost a year. He just disappeared. His last entry was, damn, my computer has some kind of virus or something. And then he was gone. But he used to say, casus belli. We don't need no stinking casus belli. It makes you wonder, why do they even bother with the lies? Why don't they just tell us, hey, you know what? We're going to kill Persians because we like to. We're going to adopt the Israeli model, and we're going to take all of Eurasia as our West Bank. We're going to build walls everywhere, and we're going to, you know, wage low-level permanent warfare against every tribe between Turkey and China forever. I mean, why not be honest? And then they could say, and you know what? Every once in a while, 3,000 or so of you are going to die in terrorist attacks, but that's the cost of doing business. Right? And then Americans, what are Americans going to do about it? Not a damn thing. Americans go, yeah, I'm proud to die in a terrorist attack if that's the cost of doing business for the right to murder everyone in Asia and take all their stuff. Whatever you call it, just make sure to tie a yellow ribbon around it, and I'll go for it. Sorry, I just, well, I'm not sorry. You're the ones who ought to be sorry, you bastards. What the hell's the matter with you? How can Americans fall for the same lies again and again? And really, why do they have to bother lying to us? Because when they get caught, nobody cares. Or the people who do care say, hey, you know, Dick Cheney ought to be put on trial for torturing people to death and stuff. And they say, no. And then what do? Nothing. You know, everybody talks about what wimps the French are. They didn't get, their banks didn't get a big bailout over there. Because they took to the street and said, we will burn this city down. You're not going to loot us. All across Europe. In Iceland, government fell. Riot police were getting scared out in front of that place. Somebody went in and told the prime minister, dude, you got to step down, man. And all over Europe, massive riots in the street over the amount of fraud that has been committed by their governments in collusion with their most powerful financial interests. Riots in the streets, and maybe they don't know what's the cause or the solution or whatever, but they know they're pissed and they know who to be pissed at. What do Americans do about it? Nothing. Nothing. Americans follow the Rachel Maddow angle, which might as well be the George Bush angle, which is that you're unpatriotic if you don't agree with whatever the government says is the proper solution to the problem that the government says they didn't cause. Lead, follow, or get out of the way, right, Rachel Maddow? That's the way we're supposed to do it. That's patriotism. In fact, if you disagree with what the government wants to do, well, then you disagree with what they claim their actual benevolent purpose is. If government wants to do X in order to accomplish Y, and you disagree with X, then you also disagree with Y. It must be. If you're not in favor of the stimulus package, you must be some kind of Republican pro-torture monger hypocrite who no one ought to listen to a word you say. And there's no other explanation. You couldn't have a point. You must be one of them. That's really my favorite too, man. You know, here they loot us. That's really, I've been trying to pick out what's my favorite today. That's my favorite. They've got us, according to Bloomberg News.com calculations, they got us on the hook for $10 trillion. Now, that was already the entire national debt since George Washington. And they just doubled it basically. They just put us on the hook, at least loan guarantees and all this stuff, for $10 trillion. This is the greatest act of larceny in the history of the world. Never mind all the, well, I guess not including the giant bubble that was also simply just an act of fraud in the first place. But this bailout, this just outright theft from the people of this land by our government on behalf of the people who run Citigroup and Bank of America is so, I need to go take an English class and improve my vocabulary. It's just the scale of it and the brazenness. We're literally, they're coming, they've got a gun to your head, and they're telling you, we are taking $10 trillion from you. But it's for you. It's to save your job. It's to save the economy, because we care about you. So we're taking $10 trillion from you. And it works. It works. And you think about the con game where like some guy gets with this lady, she's got a few kids, he tells her he loves her, he gets access to her bank account, and then one day he disappears and they find out a few years later that wasn't even really his name. He was just a con man. You hear about that stuff in the news from time to time. Pretty jerky thing to do. There's that movie with Nicolas Cage where he tricks the greedy businessman into giving him all his money. He's a con man. Our government and our central bank, I mean, that's their con, and that's the level of sophistication, too. A cold gun barrel to your temple. Your money or your life. And now, let me explain to you why this is all because I care about you. And I'm going to spend this money I'm taking from you on you. And it's going to stimulate you and be good for you. Unbelievable. I mean, it really is incredible. You've got to hand it to the people who came up with the central bank. I mean, basically, their gamble was, people don't understand banking. I mean, that was basically it, right? Banking? I don't want to talk about banking. You already lost my interest, Horton. Banking? No. That's something for one of those weird guys with the weird names who goes to one of those weird schools and studies some weird branch of things that I'm not interested in. And that was the gamble back in 1910. In fact, I don't know. I don't mean to be patronizing. I certainly end up, you know, going on and on in a know-it-all kind of fashion because I'm up against such lies and whatever. I know I probably sound pretty damn arrogant most of the time, but I really hate it when people are patronizing to me, and I'm not trying to be patronizing to you. I don't know really whether people know this story or not. I mean, for me, it's old hat. And for you guys who, you know, deliberately tune in to anti-war radio on any kind of regular basis, I don't know whether to assume you guys already know this story or not. But anyway, I'll go ahead and tell you. Especially just, you know, for newbies who don't know the story. It's pretty interesting stuff. Got my attention way back when I was a young kid. Because the whole shenanigan aspect is right there in front of your face. Almost impossible to ignore. And that's the story that Murray Rothbard and G. Edward Griffin and others have told about the creature from Jekyll Island. And that is the Federal Reserve Bank. The Federal Reserve System, they call it, in the United States. The central bank. The government central bank. Now, you might think that the government central bank was created as part of the New Deal, when all the bright brain trusters decided that the wild excesses of capitalism had just gone crazy and destroyed the economy, and so that they needed to create all these new laws so that government could control the economy to prevent it from getting so far out of whack. But you'd be wrong. Actually, the Federal Reserve Act itself was signed into law in 1913. And its creators were not a bunch of New Deal brain truster types who wanted to, which, you know, a big part of the New Deal was just hiring a bunch of fascist corporatists to run everything anyway. But also there were the idealistic, you know, kind of abstract dealing. And there are some KGB agents thrown in there as well, of course. But anyway, basically, it was not a bunch of progressive New Dealer types that that you know came up with the Federal Reserve as a way to limit the influence of bankers. The Federal Reserve Act actually was written by the bankers. I know, you're shocked, right? A regulatory agency that's part of the United States government being created by the capitalists so that they can be regulated by it. Why? That just doesn't make any sense at all, because we all know, don't we, somehow, that all people who are in business want a completely free market and just can't stand the thought that someone would ever regulate them. Oh, well, see, that's actually wrong. It turns out that America's a pretty wealthy country, and around the turn of the last century, there's a lot more wealth growing up in places like Texas and California and Colorado and the centers of power in New York City were basically losing their monopoly. The J.P. Morgan syndicate was basically losing their cartel control over who has access to capital. And of course, there's never really been a free market in money in this country. It's always been cartelized and done in cooperation, and sometimes, you know, against the interests, or you know, there's been fighting back and forth between bankers and politicians about what ought to be done when and what have you. But basically, in the lead up to the creation of the Federal Reserve, J.P. Morgan was the Fed, and they all would participate in the fraud of fractional reserve banking, not only loaning out money that people deposit, which to me, you know, how can they give you your deposit back if they loaned it to somebody else? But I guess if you know that that's the deal, that it's fractional in that way, that's one thing. But then these guys take it, not only do they loan out the money you put in deposit, but they loan out 10 times that based on your deposit, with the fractional reserve ratio that they keep there. And so fractional reserve banking is really the evil in that it's inflationary, artificial bank credit expansion. And the degree to which J.P. Morgan was able to use his influence to get all the big bankers at a table and bark orders at them and force them to loan money to each other at interest rates he dictated or whatever, and manage the system, was the degree to which they could get away with it. And the degree to which market forces are just too powerful for even J.P. Morgan and his big fat finger shaking in your face, was the degree to which they wanted to go into business with the U.S. government as their partner. And so, in 1910, using aliases and fake mustaches and fake last names, well, that's the aliases part, but disguises, and telling their family, lying to their own families about where they were going, Frank Vanderlip from the National City Bank, and let's see, it was Andrew Mellon, I think, was the Assistant Secretary of the Treasury at the time. And then there was Jacob Schiff from Kuhn Loeb and Company. Anyway, Rockefellers and Morgans basically met together. And then I guess there were also Rothschilds and other interests from Europe in on the meeting as well. Again, with Mellon, the Assistant Secretary of the Treasury. And, oh, Nelson Aldrich, who was the powerful Republican head of the Senate Banking Committee. And they wrote up the plan for the central bank, which would be the lender of last resort. It would have the government's gun in its hand and the ability to force people to accept its new paper money no matter what. And they would dictate the interest rates, and they would take the place of J.P. Morgan. Of course, the place was run by Morgan men, at least all throughout World War II. Until really the Rockefeller faction became more powerful. What happened was Nelson Aldrich introduced the bill in the Senate, and they rejected it because the people really rejected it. It was I mean, come on. This was Nelson Aldrich. He was the most powerful Republican bankster representative on the Senate Banking Committee. His daughter had just married John D. Rockefeller Jr., and the American people knew it. And they didn't believe in this guy, and they weren't going to go for that. And so what they did was they basically scrapped it, and they had some millionaire Democrats in the House of Representatives. A guy named Glass was, I believe, the one who put his name on the bill and sponsored it. And then the bankers went around giving speeches to chambers of commerce around the country saying, it's Bolshevism, it's terrible, oh no, anything but progressivism, oh no, big government, oh please don't throw me in the briar patch, J.P. Morgan cried. And everybody fell for it. And still to this day, people think that banks want a free market? No, if there was a free market, they would not be able to create multi-trillion dollar pyramid schemes like we see, the consequences of which are coming due on us right now. That can't happen in a free market economy. That's the Federal Reserve System that does that. They're the lender of last resort. They're the inspirer of confidence that should not exist. And they mandate reserve ratios, and they mandate artificially low interest rates, and they control the economy for the good of the big banks. Really, I guess, I don't know what the turnover is in terms of, like, you know, family power within these banks or whatever, you know, I ain't no Rothbard. I keep track of all that stuff myself, but, I'll tell you this. Frank Vanderlip from the National City Bank in 1910 helped write the Federal Reserve Act. In 2009, Gaither, the former head of the New York Fed, who now has been put in charge of, what is he now? He's the new Secretary of Treasury because Bernanke's still in there at the Fed. He comes in, and he, in cooperation with Ben Bernanke, the head of the Federal Reserve Open Market Committee Board, the chairman of the board of the Open Market Committee, they're creating hundreds of billions of dollars of money to give to Citigroup, it's now called. And that ain't an accident. And that ain't free market capitalism. And I can understand if people don't really understand, you know, how business cycles work and how fractional reserve banking works. And they look at our economy and they think of it as a capitalist economy, even though really everybody knows. We learn as little kids, well, it's a mixed economy. It's been a mixed economy for since long before you were born, right? But no, anyway, it's a capitalist problem or it's a capitalist economy, and whatever's wrong with it is a capitalist problem, I guess, if that's what TV says over and over. And I guess it could be understood, you know, it's pretty easy to understand why people, you know, can get buffaloed into believing that. But it seems like abandoning what little of a free market model we have right when the consequences are coming due is the worst thing. I mean, if I was a liberal leftist who hated capitalism and hated capitalists and blamed those bastards at Citigroup for all of this, I would say, yeah, you wanted free market capitalism, you called it, we'll give you free market capitalism. You get all the reward from committing your fraud all these years during Greenspan's bubble, and now you suffer the consequences from the risk that you took, you bastards. And let Citigroup cease to exist. Let it go bankrupt. Let the criminals who ran it go get real jobs, providing actual goods and services to people, or let those CEOs starve in the goddamn gutter. Why should we have to prop up their failed business? We know that we should not have to. We know that we do have to because they have the guns of the federal government. And it's been this way throughout. You look at the history of war. You look at the history of the American Empire in the 20th century. And it is the history of the men who created the central bank. The same ones were the ones who got us into World War One. And I don't just mean Woodrow Wilson was president at the time. I mean the guys at the Morgan Bank and all this. Read Carol Quigley, tells the whole story. Bill Clinton's foreign policy professor tells the whole story in his book, Tragedy and Hope. These are the men who got us into the First World War, who got us into the Second, who wrote the Charter for the Bank for International Settlements between the World Wars, who wrote the Charter for the United Nations and the Bretton Woods institutions after it, who got us, who created the Cold War when the Morgans handed their power off to the Rockefellers, or the Rockefellers wrested it away, or however exactly that worked. When World War II was over, the country was turned over to John Foster and Alan Dulles, who were Rockefeller's lawyers. That's all they were. They were Rockefeller's lawyers. One of them became the head of the CIA. The other one became the Secretary of State and forged our Cold War policy. There's an excellent book to go along with Rothbard's Great Studies of the Fed, What Has Government Done to Our Money and the Case Against the Fed. And I also mentioned The Creature from Jekyll Island by J. Edward Griffin is a good one. But Rothbard has a very short book that you can read the whole thing online as one big Lou Rockwell essay. It's really not that long. I mean, it's fully doable. And it's called Wall Street, Banks, and American Foreign Policy. And to me, it's like all of my favorite kind of John Bircher conspiracy theories from back in the day, only told by, well, the definition of the plumb line libertarian Murray Rothbard, rather than right-wing populist nationalist types, which is mostly where you get that stuff. And man, it's just excellent. Wall Street, Banks, and American Foreign Policy. Anybody who's not taken a look at that, I strongly urge you to do so. In fact, in that he characterizes World War II as a compromise between the Morgans and the Rockefellers. The Morgans get to have their war in Europe. The Rockefellers get to have their war in Asia. Didn't have a damn thing with, stopping Holocausts or protecting England or, well, I guess protecting Morgan investments in England was a big part of that. But anyway, you get the message. All right, I'm going to shut up for a moment and let you guys have a say. It's 512-646-6446, 512-646-6446. You guys in the chat room, you have to call in, dude. Otherwise, I sound like a jackass saying the phone number. I want calls. I want to learn how to get good at taking calls and making it sound good and interesting for people, so there you go. You anti-war radio hardcores, man, it's your responsibility to take part in the show now. How do you like that? I'm going to line them up now with the guilt trip. Boy, there's a bunch of other stuff I was going to talk about on the show today. Did I tell the Jekyll Island story? What did I leave out of that? Yeah. The name of the game is bailout, man. All your most hated corporate fascist master guys that you hate, they can't do all those things that you hate them for, but for their partnership with the national government. Don't you see? Central banking is the greatest scam ever, ever. It's just a scam. That's all it is. Big scam. Biggest one ever, ever. And really, the only thing keeping you from recognizing that at this point is what? That you have to admit to yourself that, like, you thought you knew everything, but you didn't know that? No. Welcome to the real world. All right, so it looks like I got Austinite calling in here. Hey, I'm Scott. Welcome to the show.
Hey, this is D in Texas. Good show, man.
You lack discipline.
Exactly.
How's it going, dude?
It's going real, real good, man. I can't wait to come up there and visit you. But would you do me and all the other listeners a favor and go over your analogy that you were doing the other day about how W. Bush was like Hoover and Obama's like FDR with how they're dealing with this financial problem in exactly all the wrong ways. You made a really good analogy, so I'll shut up now and let you respond. All right, take it easy.
Hey, cool. Thanks, man. Yeah. So here's the thing. We learned the myth about the Depression when we're kids, that the excesses of laissez-faire free market capitalism caused it. Never mind the fact that it was the Federal Reserve, which had existed for 16 years, which had created a massive bubble for World War I and then another one for the booming 20s. artificially low interest rates and artificially low reserve ratios led to a massive bubble in many sectors, but particularly, obviously, in capital goods and in the stock market, leading to the big bust. Now, Herbert Hoover was not some, you know, Ron Paul type. Herbert Hoover was much more like a Richard Nixon wage and price controls, gold standard abandoning pinko commie. He was a progressive Republican from the Northeast. He was not a small government guy. Don't confuse him with Harding and Coolidge, which I think both of them were Morgan guys, or maybe Harding was a Rockefeller guy and Coolidge was a Morgan guy or whatever. But they were basically hands-off presidents. Harding presided over the return to normalcy after the tyranny of Woodrow Wilson. Oh, and the bloody murder. Harding, the third of the three presidents, Hoover, the third of the three presidents, between Wilson and Franklin Roosevelt, the guy who was in power at the time that, of the stock market crash, he was a big government progressive, and he bought into all the theories about how government ought to intervene in order to fix the financial crisis. And what he did was, well, he did a lot of stupid things. And a lot of them were contradictory because, you know, these people have no idea what the hell they're doing. So they thought they were protecting the economy by raising protective tariffs and shutting down international trade. So, oh, those foreigners are undercutting our markets and whatever, whatever. Well, but of course they just fight back and quit buying our exports. And it's completely stupid and counterproductive. Here the world's going into depression, and all of a sudden they put up all these tariffs and make it so much harder for the division of labor to operate, which of course only made it worse. And he raised taxes too, I think. But what he also did was he tried to prop up prices by pushing wage floors to not let wages fall, by attempting to reinflate the bubble. And I don't think they were able to do like outright trillion-dollar Bush-style bailouts back then. I guess really I need to reread. It's Rothbard's America's Great Depression tells the story very well. Of course, Robert Higgs also in Depression, War, and Cold War, which I need to go back and get refreshed. But basically, he followed the policy of let's not let there be a recession and let's try to keep things going, which was what George Bush did. And George Bush did this saying, I don't want to go down in history like Herbert Hoover, a guy who was told that the sky is falling and that we're about to have a Great Depression if you don't do something, and then who didn't do something. Well, that's not the real history of Herbert Hoover. But George Bush, hell, someone might have even told him, you know, Hoover was a big government liberal Democrat, or, you know, liberal, whatever, not liberal in the sense of caring at all about liberty, but you know what I mean, big government, kind of statist, whatever. But still, it doesn't matter, because the history is a lie, and George Bush didn't want to be compared to Hoover doing nothing. So he, of course, created trillions of dollars as well. Now then, when FDR was running for president, he ran as a hard money, small government, tax cutting, spending cutting Democrat. And in fact, his vice president, as Tom Woods has been reiterating in major media over the last few weeks, his vice presidential candidate in 1932 accused Hoover of taking America down the road to socialism with all of his intervention in the economy. What we need is hard money and a hands-off approach. And then when FDR took his inaugural address, he declared war. And he demanded from the Congress emergency powers against the Great Depression as though we were being invaded by a foreign foe. All the rules are off. The Constitution no longer does a damn thing except create my office. It certainly doesn't bind it, and now I'm going to do whatever I want with you. He declared banking holidays, took the country off the gold standard, which we remain to this day. We're sort of partially put back on, bastardized, half-assed versions of the gold standard after the World War II finally ended. But then what Roosevelt did was he carried on Hoover's New Deal. He did not do anything different than Hoover except in matters of degree, and that he followed Hoover's policy only even more so. And this is what prolonged the Depression, because what happened was prices were artificially high from the big artificial boom, and if they had only done nothing and let the economy shake out the bad debt and let people start saving again and investing in their property and, you know, letting the economy recover, it couldn't possibly have lasted as long as it ended up lasting. And in fact, I read something just the other day that pointed out, you know, if Roosevelt had left after his two terms, he would have been a failed president. Everybody would hate him all through history. He just had to hang on and get us into a war to save his legacy. Now we love him because he got so many people killed. Helped make the world a safer place for Stalin and Mao Zedong. Now he's a fucking hero. He had to hang on for four terms so he could kill enough people to become a great president. And as Robert Higgs shows in Depression, War, and Cold War, and as even the pro-FDR Keynesian liberal economist types now admit, the New Deal didn't save America from the Great Depression. Didn't even really help at all. But they say then the war helped. It was the war that saved America from the Great Depression, finally being a bunch of demand and getting people back to work and whatever. But it's always broken window fallacy and ignoring what that wealth would have been put to instead if it had been allowed to go to productive uses. And you know, the whole time, the government, throughout the New Deal, they were experimenting with interest rates, raising them, lowering them, taxes this way, taxes that way, massive spending, and then try to balance the budget one year, and then massive spending again, and whatever. The whole thing's a disaster. And of course, the liberals now want you to believe that the only reason that the New Deal didn't quite, quote-unquote, work is because they just didn't spend enough. They just didn't borrow enough. They just didn't stimulate quite enough, but that then it was World War II, which finally did, and they swear by that. Even though it seems kind of nonsensical, doesn't it, that if you take a bunch of wealth and you turn it into high explosives, and then you drop those high explosives on, say, I don't know, a factory that produces wealth, that's a net loss, right? And that's a net loss when wealth is destroyed. That's what it is, or else it isn't what it is, or something. I mean, right? Okay, good. So, and Robert Higgs shows that how a lot of the New Deal controls over the economy basically stayed on in the form of war controls over the economy during World War II, and then, in effect, quite a bit of the New Deal was repealed when those war provisions were finally repealed at the end of the Second World War. And then, as Robert Higgs shows in Depression, War, and Cold War, it was 1946 that was the greatest year of growth in American history. It was when the New Deal, to a great degree anyway, or to quite a large degree, and the war finally ended, that the people were finally able to, you know, start producing wealth. Now, it could be said, obviously, that when government takes a bunch of money and puts it into this thing or that thing, that, well, for example, developing jet engines or making a freeway that goes to this town or not that town, that people benefit here, there, or the other place. But that always is a problem of the seen and the unseen and where that wealth would have gone otherwise. So people can say, oh, well, all the factories, not only that were put into production, but were even built, new factories that were built to provide for war material, stayed open and became part of the permanent infrastructure and wealth of the country and whatever after. And so that makes it an investment. But I think it's a pretty safe bet that if private people with their own money weren't willing to invest in that factory, it wasn't a good investment, or they would have done it. If the government had to do it, it's because it was actually a big freaking waste. That's why they had to hold a gun to everybody's head in order to pay for it all. And so there, you know, Roosevelt took power in 1933, and the Great Depression ended in 1946. And then even now, and this is true for pretty much every news channel and everything else, that you see and read in the modern media, if they have to admit that the Great Depression wasn't completely solved by the New Deal, then they say it's just because they didn't spend enough. Yeah, right around 1937, that's when Roosevelt was, you know, dumbly decided, you know, mistakenly decided to listen to the conservatives and not spend so much anymore. And that's what caused the Depression to not be permanently solved. If only he had doubled or tripled or you know, increased the spending by 100 times, then it would have saved the economy. Propping up a bunch of artificially, well, see, I guess they had such deflation. I need to get Bob Hicks back on the show, don't I? As they tried to prop up prices at first, but then that didn't work. And then the prices fell so low, they ended up destroying food in front of starving people in order to try to drive up the price of the food. It's again, it's one of these things where, you know, I try to think in my own mind, go back in time, the 1930s, like, okay, here's this government agent is telling me he's got to destroy all the crops in town, and not allow the people who grew them to sell them to feed their own family with the proceeds, or to allow any of the people who can buy their food at depressed prices. And hey, since it's the Depression and everybody's broke, hey, at least wheat's cheaper now, right? At least oranges are cheaper now, whatever, whatever. But no, that was forbidden. I'm trying to imagine what it would be like to have the G-Man try to explain to me that, listen, I know that you're trying to sell your crop to a hungry person for a mutually agreed price, but I'm an expert. I'm with the scientists from the New Deal, and I know things that you just can't comprehend or understand about complicated money and banking and prices. But you just have to take my word for it and trust me. And by the way, you know, I'll put you in jail if you resist me. I'm going to have to forbid you from selling this good or service to that person at a mutually agreed price. Will not allow it. In fact, they turned some kind of proportion of the American people into snitches in this country, people ratting on each other for charging too little. Artificial price floors and all this kind of stuff. I don't think that's exactly the kind of depression we're headed for now. There seems to be a deflationary period going on now because no matter what the government tries to tell us, people know, again, with their simple logic, never mind what the guy in the suit with the gun says he's an expert in, we know that when times are bad, we need to start saving. We need to start paying back some of that debt. We got in too far over our head. We got money on our credit card, and we're not so sure if our job's even going to last. And we start acting right in a recession, and they want to stop that. And so the quote-unquote multiplier effect of the fractional reserve system is basically being hampered, and they're not able to introduce as much new money into circulation, new credit into circulation through the banking system, because people are not taking out as many loans. But on the other hand, the government, in their attempts, so far futile, well, I don't know how futile, but anyway, in their attempts to get us to spend, by injecting all this new money into circulation and whatever, is that's inflation. And that is the difference, one of the major differences between the Austrian school of economics and I think all others, is all others define inflation as when prices go up for some reason, huh? And the Austrians explain that no, inflation is an increase in the money supply. Prices going up is the result of that. And, you know, I don't know all, I'm not an expert in all these, M1 and M3 numbers and this, that, and the other thing, but it seems to me like the government is creating trillions and trillions of new dollars for all this stimulus and all this bailout. And I fear that what it eventually means is $100 bills, like the guy was saying on the blog at lourockwell.com yesterday, $100 bills would be worthless. Our highest paper currency that we pass around, that they'll be like pennies. And of course, if that happens, if government destroys the money, then that means it completely destroys the money. That means a complete breakdown in the division of labor. That means people have to start bartering. They have to start using, you know, what few precious coins they've been able to save. It means that people cannot engage in their contracts. They cannot fulfill their contracts. All their prices are completely screwed up. You know, if a $100 bill becomes a penny, then you can't get enough cash to do your business in. And, you know, it's just a freaking catastrophe, man. And these people, they really act on this basic misunderstanding that comes from the Great Depression. If only FDR had spent more, the Depression would have been over by 1935 or something, I guess they believe. And so what we have to do is spend more. And they refuse to understand that the bubble was bad. The bubble was an artificial good time. It turns out that, you know, every Joe Schmuck can't afford, you know, to remodel his whole house and drive a giant SUV and have a giant flat screen TV and all these things on credit. It just wasn't viable to run things that way. Now, if you're a rich guy, you can do that, right? If you're a rich guy, you can have a giant house. You can refurbish the kitchen every few years. You can have a giant truck and a giant flat screen TV and whatever. But we somehow think that the average schmuck in this country can afford to live like that? It was an illusion. It wasn't a real good time. That was an artificial good time. Oh, yeah, you know, I'm deep, deep in debt, but the price of my house keeps appreciating so fast, all I have to do is keep refinancing it, and I just get free money for the rest of my life because my house is just going to keep going up in value forever and ever and ever. That wasn't good times. That was an illusion. The recession is the correction. It's just as simple as that. It's just a fact. If you don't think so, well, I don't know what the hell is the matter with you. The bubble was an artificial high. This is the consequence. And again, and I want to emphasize this, you could be a liberal lefty, you could be a moderate Democrat or a moderate Republican of some kind and say, you cold-hearted, terrible libertarians, I think that there ought to be welfare and food stamps and unemployment benefits for people who are thrown out of work during this terrible transition period between the bubble and the whatever. And I would disagree with you because I think all that is bad economics, but whatever. You care about people, you want government to give people unemployment, whatever. I got bigger fights to get in than that. But at least recognize that the people who are trying to stimulate the economy, to reinflate the bubble, to get us back to where we were, are only making matters worse. They're destroying the economy even worse, destroying the currency, threatening a serious Zimbabwe, Weimar-type situation that includes a complete breakdown in the division of labor, people's entire savings destroyed from the face of the earth, and then, you know, the societal consequences of those things, all from an attempt to reinflate a bubble that never should have been. So if you want to say there's got to be a cushion for the people who fall because they were fooled by the Federal Reserve's artificially low interest rates into thinking that they ought to expand their business this way, that way, and the other way right at the time when they should have been saving and not expanding their business, and so everybody's fallen. I'm sitting here. I'm the one telling you it's all the Federal Reserve's fault. It's all the damn government's fault. Why should it be that everybody went into construction's got to pay? Why should it be that everybody who, you know, foolishly thought it was a good time to go into whatever business went into it? After all, they were being completely and totally lied to and manipulated and bullied by the central bank into their bad decisions. So as long as that's the case, if you want to argue, fine, give them all unemployment benefits and whatever, whatever, fine. You know what, I will have Tom Woods on and we'll argue about that and I'll have him explain why that's bad policy. But still, the idea that what we need is trillions of dollars, trillions and trillions and trillions to stimulate the economy, to bail out the banks, to save the financial system is horribly destructive. And I can just see it. I mean, is this how it's really going to be? We're 2-3 years from now? I have to sit here and say, wow, here we are. You know, LA's on fire. There's a revolution. Society's completely broken down. There's martial law in the streets. There's price controls and shortages and riots and hyperinflation and the breakdown in the division of labor and people starving to death in America like a goddamn third world country. And I'm going to have to sit and say, like, yeah, well, this was all completely predictable. Anybody could have told you that's what happens when you dump trillions of new dollars into circulation. I sure hope that's not the case. You know, there are a lot of things about economics I don't understand. And maybe it could be that they're trying to push on a string, but it just doesn't work. And that if we don't take all their stimulus money and go out and, you know, take out bigger loans and help expand bank credit by going along with their social engineering, maybe there won't be an inflationary holocaust, but it sure seems like we're headed toward one. And it, you know, why should it be that if the Austrian school libertarian economists in the early 2000s said, hey, you're creating a bubble, it's going to pop, this is a bad deal, like, say, for example, Mark Thornton, or say, for example, Ron Paul, saying Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac, Federal Reserve, artificially low interest rates, Alan Greenspan, lousy job, giant bubble, setting us up for a huge crash, could be the end of dollar hegemony, look out where you're going. And then now they're telling us, wait, you're the ones who caused the problem, now what you're doing is wrong, now what you're doing is going to cause inflation, now what you're doing is going to make matters worse, rather than letting bad investments go bad and be and have good investments taken back up again by people who make good decisions. We're just going to ignore them. This society is just going to ignore the people who got this right the whole time and who are now predicting that what they're setting us up for could be absolutely catastrophic levels of inflation. As a society, we're just going to say, fuck it. You know what? Barack Obama is smarter than Ron Paul, right? Yeah, Barack Obama understands a lot more about business and how economics works than Ron Paul does, right? No, of course not. Has Barack Obama actually ever had a job where he worked for a living? I guess they say that he worked at the ice cream store before he went off to college. So, yeah, I guess he probably does understand a hell of a lot about it. Anyway, you could read 4 or 5 books by Ron Paul about economics and compare and contrast. Although that's not, you know, I don't want to just appeal to authority. Ron Paul's writing makes sense as opposed to a lot of other people who've written even more than him about economics. And in fact, again, I'll mention this, Scott Sutton has a blog, and he has a blog entry called Ron Paul Told Us So that goes back 30 years, and it's every relevant speech that Ron Paul gave about business cycle theory, bubbles in the dot-com and housing markets and all the rest of this stuff. It's great. And boy, you can see, wow, there it is, year 2000. Ron Paul is saying, oh, Greenspan's refusing to let there be a recession. After the stock market crash, you got to let there be a recession. You don't want to build up another bubble. You're just making your problem worse. Does anybody really think, let me ask you, does anybody really think if America had gone through a recession in the year 2000, 2001, that it would have been worse than what we're going through now? Okay, because see, now we're going back in time, looking at hindsight thing, whatever. Well, Ron Paul had the foresight. Said, you better let there be a recession now. Obviously, the whole dot-com bubble was a bunch of irrational exuberance, wasn't it? It was an artificial high where any goofball who claims that he's got an idea for some software he's going to come up with can get millions of dollars dumped in his lap. Oh, yeah, that's tenable. That's a legitimate, you know, free market distribution of resources going on there. Yeah, right. That bubble didn't need to be propped back up. That bubble needed to pop, didn't it? That dot-com bubble. We understand that, don't we? Same thing. And what Ron Paul said was, it's not a good idea to just move the bubble from dot-coms to housing, from dot-coms to war. There shouldn't be a bubble. And by creating a new one with your artificially low interest rates and your artificially high reserve ratios, You're creating a disaster, Alan Greenspan, you dumb bastard. Only he didn't call him that. And, of course, that's what Alan Greenspan did. And Ron Paul was right. And the Austrian school was right. And, again, you could not be a libertarian. You could totally disagree that there should be no government or extremely limited government. You might have in mind a wonderful welfare state that would be administered by you in a perfect way. And believe that somehow that's a political reality that'll ever come true. You could believe all that and still understand that a recession is a correction. It's not, oh, capitalism failing us all of a sudden from when everything was just fine before the recession started. It's a correction from an artificial high. And propping us up, back up to an artificial high, just like with drugs, just like with anything else, prolongs the consequences and makes them worse. So how's that, Z and Austin, for answering your question? Now, I know you lack discipline, but if you go read America's Great Depression by Murray Rothbard, I think you'll be pleased. Now, let me see if anybody else is calling in on this thing. It's 512-646-6446. Only got about 10 minutes left to kill here. If I can get this thing to even work right. Yeah. Whoa, hey, there's a bunch of people on there, man. Let me see if I can get this going here. This is 937 area code there. Oh, got to hit the button. Hey, I'm Scott. Welcome to the show.
Oh, hey, Scott.
How's it going?
Troy again. Yeah, I was listening to your thing.
Oh.
I wanted to tell you what I called in for. Did you see the John Stewart's interview or John Sununu or whatever, Sununu last night?
No, I missed it.
Oh, yeah. They
I think the TiVo thing recorded it, though, man. I'll try to go back and look.
Oh, yeah. He was saying, I think Sununu's a Republican, and he sounded like one of those Republican guys. They were talking about the economy, and Sununu, he was doing kind of the standard Republican line while they're trying to pretend like they're for the free market, even though, you know, they've been back at George Bush all these years. But some of the stuff John said just really, God, it's so bad. He said, first, the big one he said was, well, we got to do something. If that means we got to go out and dig holes and fill them, well, that's what we need to, do that to fix this economy. And then the other zinger he had was, what was it? Unintended consequences. That's what it was. It's like, well, everything's got unintended consequences, so why don't, We might as well not do anything, so that's just the deal with that.
Yeah, you know, I sometimes imagine, like, what it would be like to actually get John Stewart in a situation where he had to hang out with you for a couple hours and get a chance to try to set him straight on some things. Because, boy, you know, you talk about potential, but it's just, he's good on the whole, you know, anti-war thing mostly, but economically, man, these liberals are already driving me crazy, and you're just going to get nothing but more of that. Because I mean, really, what are you going to do? Get all these people to admit that Keynes is wrong, that their whole theory of economics is wrong, that America actually has been basically a, you know, democratic / fascist country for 100 years, that there was no free market equation pretty much anywhere to be found on Wall Street in the run-up to this crash. You're going to get them to actually repudiate every false thing that they believe? Yeah, forget it. It's like asking people to renounce their religion at this point. Freedom causes problems. Only government can solve them. Which I guess is why the Soviet Union was perfect, and the degree of freedom we've had here has torn our society apart. I'm not sure, but anyway, that's something like the thinking going on there.
Definitely. Oh, there was one when you were talking about World War II. That's definitely the other biggest myth we have out there. I know what I used to think, and I think what most other people think. Whenever you say anything about World War II, even about and he got a deliberate blind eye of FDR or anything like that. And you'll probably even get people to admit that, you know, nuking Hiroshima and Nagasaki was wrong, but they'll think, well, if you're against World War II, well, then, you know, that basically means you're, to some degree, you're basically for Hitler, whether, you know, the most positive way they think it is, well, you're just some kind of naive peacenik who thinks that if Roosevelt or Churchill just went over and gave Hitler a big hug, well, then they'd have a good cry and everything would have ended up just fine.
Yeah, well, and that's because everybody just wants to deal in broad narratives, broad strokes, man. They don't want to deal with the facts that the people who promoted that war, what they accomplished was saving Stalin. And what they accomplished was the creation of communist China, which ended up killing more Chinese than the Japanese could ever dreamed of killing there. And creating a Cold War and turning America into a permanent empire that's now killed as many people in the world as the freaking Nazis. So, no, fuck World War II. How do you like that? All right, that's me.
I get a lot more fans.
Thanks, man.
Yeah, no problem.
All right, 770 area code, you're on.
Hey, how's it going, dude? This is Perger.
Hey, Perger, how you doing, man?
Hey, dude, doing all right. Just had a quick comment for you, because actually I think the analogy you made earlier, and when I say earlier, I want to say yesterday, as far as economics goes, I think that was a great example when you were saying that how spending a way out of a depression isn't good. Because, firstly, you create, as you said earlier in the program, inflation. But then, of course, once the inflation kind of hits and then the prices start to go up, well, then, of course, the only thing government can really do is try to enact price controls. And it brought me back to this past summer. Of course, I'm in the Southeast. So we had, in Atlanta, a really big gas. They called it a gas shortage.
Right.
But I forgot where I heard it. They were saying that the gas shortage wasn't really a shortage so much as it was people who, I want to say that they capped the price of gas.
Yeah, that's exactly what happened. It was because of the hurricane. Which storm was it?
I forgot which one it was. It was. I want to say it wasn't even a storm right then.
Well, but I thought it was a hurricane or something. But the thing was that some politicians had announced, and I forget whether it was national politicians or state politicians. I think it was state politicians had announced they were going to viciously prosecute anybody who was gouging at the gas pump. And what that meant was they didn't even say what the cap was. They just said, if you're unfairly charging a high price for gasoline, we'll prosecute you. They didn't even give them a number. And so what that meant was, if you're a gas station owner, you're afraid to raise your price at all. They might come and get you in a legal situation that'll cost you millions or something. So you don't want to pick a fight at all. But so what that means is you cannot charge enough for your gas per gallon to be able to make enough money off it to pay the trucks to come out there, because the local distribution networks were disrupted. So what they needed to do was be able to bring in gasoline from a couple of states away or whatever. But they could not afford to buy the wholesale because they were afraid to get prosecuted for charging retail. It's the same thing as any price control anywhere. They want to sell you on price controls on bread or milk. I mean, that's coming, right? We're going to have massive inflation and people immediately are going to say, I need bread and milk for my kids. You're charging me $350 for a loaf of bread and I refuse to pay it, and there's going to be a riot here and whatever. And so then the government says, okay, we have no idea where this inflation came from. It must be, you know, somebody demanded a raise at work and that caused inflation or something, they'll say. But then they'll say, so we need price controls. They'll blame it on the storekeeper for trying to charge you so much for bread and milk. And they'll say, okay, that's it. Nobody can charge more than X amount for a loaf of bread. But what that means is then up the chain, people are either going to not be able to distribute the bread to the retail store. They're going to not be able to afford to even bake the bread and put it in the truck. And it may get to the point where they're not even able to afford to harvest the actual wheat, process it into flour, and even have a factory running to bake it in, because the wholesale cost of all of these operations now exceeds what the government will allow the retailer to charge. And then what happens is the whole system just breaks down. Now there's no bread or milk at all. The government will blame the shopkeeper. the government will say that the retail store owners in this country are, how dare they charge so much for milk and bread, those sons of bitches. Only Barack Obama can bring you fairness in the bread and milk market. And those days are coming, and the price controls just lead straight to shortages and eventually riots and disturbance and everything else. And that's it for Anti-War Radio. Thanks for listening. See you guys Tuesday, 11 to 1 California time.